Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of this podcast and the founder of the Rise of Justice Movement. I would like to give a very brief viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by one of my favorite content creators, also known as Sex Ed Princess on social media. Jill, welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. Feel free to introduce yourself.
I'm so happy to be here, and it's so nice to talk to you and to be able to talk about, what I do and the importance of sex and sexuality and sex education, all that stuff combined with survivor justice and sexual violence. And it's just so important to me. But hi, I am Jill. I use she, her pronouns. As mentioned on social media, I go by Sex Ed Princess, and I talk about everything sex education, human sexuality, reproductive health, and just everything I always say that you would learn in your high school health class, or you should have learned in your high school health class, but likely did not. So I hopefully am your social media big sister, giving you all the info and the knowledge that you should have been given way earlier.
You've definitely opened my eyes a lot. We've been connected on social media for a little while now, and you've opened my eyes a lot about, understanding like body image and understanding, again, like you said, that sex ed that I should have received like many, many, many moons ago. I'm kind of showing my age a little bit. I mean, I didn't just graduate in 2015 or anything, right? But you live in southeastern Pennsylvania, and you work in sex ed and advocacy locally and also nationally. And per your website, you started your journey in this field at Muhlenberg College as an undergraduate student looking to get involved on campus, and then you joined Voices of Strength immediately and immediately fell in love with the work and developed a passion for educating others. Walk us through what had you join that campus group. That's a sexual and gender violence peer education group. Walk us through that journey. What was it like finding, that group on campus? Because a lot of students I know do not have access to resources like this on certain campuses. But what was that like for you? And what led you to doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, this is definitely like the beginning of all of it. But so I, content warning for talking about, sexual violence and dating violence and abuse. But I had been in an abusive relationship in my freshman year of college, and I didn't get any of that education that we all really should have had in high school about what healthy relationships look like and what signs of abuse really are. And so I was experiencing this, and I eventually left that partner, and there was stalking and violence and all of those things even thereafter that when I ended the relationship. And I felt so lost. I was like, nobody talks about this. Who here has like experienced the same thing I had? I didn't know anybody like personally that really had. I hadn't talked to a lot of people, but of course, nobody talks about it. So it is way more common than anyone considers. And I got an email one day. I was sitting in my dorm room, and it was like, hey, we're starting this new group on campus. And I immediately applied to it. And so I was, I'm not the original founder of the group of Voices of Strength, but I was one of the original members of the group. And it's so amazing that the group at Muhlenberg College still exists today, and they have such like a strong foundation within like the campus community. And it's such like a point of pride for me to always, and sometimes they ask me to come back and speak, and I talk to current members, and it's just it's a really special thing that transformed the way that I think about my own experience. And it has transformed my career and my passions, and it really helped me to discover like who I am after in the aftermath of experiencing abuse and experiencing trauma, and how I can use what happened with me to help other people, because one of the biggest thoughts I had for so long was I should have known. I should have known, and I blamed myself a lot. And then I went, wait a minute, this is not my fault. This is our education system. This is systemic. This is society, right? These are the things that we don't talk about that we really need to be, and the things we need to be educating on. So yeah, that's the beginning of it all, but the story continues.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you have an absolute incredible story that I know is going to help a lot of our viewers and a lot of our listeners, you know, understand a lot more about body image. And also, because, you know, as somebody who was sexually assaulted, I struggle with my own body image. And it's something that I've struggled with like over like the last many, many years. And can you talk about what the positive body image, obviously it varies from person to person, you know, different ways of interpreting it, but that self-discovery piece, you know what I mean? Like that self-discovery and that self-awareness, like, you know what? Society is going to tell me I need to be like this. Society is going to tell me I need to be like that. How do we overcome what society wants us to believe and what they want us to see?
Oh, that is like the question, right? Like, how do we combat societal expectations of us, whether it's in our body, whether it's our sexuality, whether it's like what we eat, how we behave, right? And all of these things are so hard, and like it's a question I still think about and toy with, and really reflect on, like, what am I doing to push against like harmful societal standards and harmful societal norms? But with bodies and body image and sex and sexuality, like, it's all so strongly interconnected, because there's something that we talk about within the sexuality space, which is like the circles of sexuality, right? And there are a bunch of them that kind of encompass all the different sexual components of us that there are. And one of those circles, one of those circles is sensuality, and like your own body and the feelings you have about your body and the sensations you feel with your body, right? Your body is this mechanism of being able to experience something sexual, or potentially enjoy something sexual, or it's your body is kind of that vessel for also holding trauma too. So it is like this, it feels like a battleground to me in so many ways, with my own experiences and hearing other people, of like, you know, we can do so many beautiful and amazing things with our body, but at the same time, our body has experienced so much trauma. And this is especially true for people who have survived abuse and sexual trauma. And I want to go back to some things you said about, like, you know, the body image and society, and, you know, we are expected often to shrink ourselves and make ourselves smaller, because that is what is deemed attractive and acceptable. And larger bodies in society are seen as unacceptable. And that is, of course, rooted in fat phobia and all of the systemic isms that are at play and interact with one another. But it's combating it and kind of pushing against society, I see, is the first step, is like talking about it. You have like saying the thing that often makes other people uncomfortable is sometimes how we can push past all of those societal things, right? They say, I think a lot about sometimes race too, right? It's like, oh, you shouldn't talk about race. You shouldn't talk about, you know, people's you shouldn't talk about sex. You shouldn't talk about all of these like taboo subjects. But when we talk about them, then the shame starts to fade. And Brené Brown does a really good, she has a lot of really amazing work about shame. And she often talks about how shame thrives and grows in silence. And it's like not, and when we talk about it, and when we bring it up, and when we start to engage with other people, then it lets this guard down of like, oh shit, like, we don't have to be ashamed of these things. We can talk about them, and then we, what, person by person, conversation by conversation, society starts to get with it. Society starts to get with it, and we it, it's a, it's a constant work in progress. It's a constant battle, especially in our current political climate, as we all are very well aware of. But yeah, that's just some of my like scattered thoughts. These are things I'm constantly toying with and always asking questions about.
And oftentimes, a lot of these questions don't have an answer, right? Because
Yeah.
we don't actually know directly. You mentioned about Brené Brown, and one of my favorite quotes from Brené Brown is, "Connection is the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment, and when they derive sustenance." Why do I always struggle with that damn word? Sustenance and strength from the relationship, Brené Brown. This means a lot to me because that connection, the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued. Literally, the core mission of my advocacy is to make sure that people feel seen, they have a seat at the table, and they are heard and they're valued for their own personal experiences, like these lived experiences. Oftentimes, people with a lived experience is left out of the conversation. And whenever we think about sexuality and we think about, oh, there's so many different things that go into this. And obviously, book banning doesn't handle this issue in an appropriate way. And it doesn't, and it never will, because education is key. And that's literally what it comes down to. And can you talk about like sex ed in like marginalized communities? So, like BIPOC, LGBTQ, and other marginalized communities, and why it's critical to get this information, the sex ed for all, essentially, is like I like to call it, like Medicare for all. But this is a sex ed for all. And why is it critical to get this information, like STD and STI prevention, and also like healthy relationships and understanding about like dating violence and how it all like intersects.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do want to note first that I am, because folks are listening and they're not seeing, but I am a white woman. Part of my like intersecting identities are I'm a white woman, I'm Jewish, I'm queer. I am able-bodied but chronically ill, right? I have all of these intersecting identities and intersections of privilege and marginalization. So I think it's important that is established before I talk about sex ed among these different marginalized communities, right? Because I can't speak for sex ed specifically for Black people and Black communities, because that is highly specific. And I know quite a few folks in the sex ed space that do that specific work, and they are trained and brilliant and have not only that the knowledge, but also experience and cultural connection. And I think it's important that, when we're talking about marginalized spaces and we're talking about education in those marginalized spaces, it's important to talk about whiteness, white supremacy, race, all of these things, right? Because there is stuff that I will never know or understand about Black communities. And not, with all of that in mind, it's also important to mention that marginalized communities like Black communities, Latine, as well as various immigrant communities, all experience systemic oppression in different ways, but systemic oppression. And this systemic oppression trickles down and translates into a lot of the sexual and reproductive health and, relationships, some of the things that you said, right? It trickles down into that stuff, right? When there is systemic racism affecting Black communities, for example, then there is a lot of surrounding mechanisms, right? In a lot of marginalized communities and communities of color, there are higher rates of HIV. There are higher rates sometimes of STIs in general. Sometimes there are higher rates of violence and trauma. And this kind of goes hand in hand with potentially higher rates of food insecurity or lacking other kinds of resources, right? And these things are all so deeply interconnected, which is why sex education and social justice are hand in hand. You cannot talk about one without talking about another. You cannot do sex education without considering the social justice components. And you know, that what I just talked about a lot were a lot of communities of color that experience marginalization, but there are also overlapping things, right? A lot of folks in communities of color might also be queer folks, might also be trans, might also be disabled or neurodivergent. And these are all communities that we have to consider that supporting and talking about and uplifting and advocating for one of them helps to advocate for a lot more of them as well. And I think a big focus of sex education, you know, to talk a little bit more now about what is often called like sexual minority groups or the LGBTQIA plus community, queer communities, right? There are a lot of different names, different things that they're called in the sex ed community, but queer sex ed specifically is a whole other kind of area of sex education that requires specificity, that requires us to talk about, hey, when you're bottoming, what should you be doing? How should you be preparing? When you are you know, in for example, bisexual women see higher rates of sexual violence than other groups of people. And it's important that we talk to these communities for their specific needs and we give them what they need because a lot of queer people, they're not going to use condoms. They don't apply to them, right? People with vulvas having sex with one another, they're not going to use a condom that goes on a penis. They're going to want to know about other potentially protective measures. And we have to be sure that we are hitting all of those marks and giving folks what they need when it comes to sex ed and being specific for all of those communities that experience systemic oppression because we cannot be adding to their systemic oppression by giving them cishet white sex ed. We have to be giving them what they actually need to thrive, not just survive.
Oh, my friend. Okay, you hit on some really, really good points. And I love talking about this subject because it's so incredibly crucial. And, I grew up in Missouri, which Missouri has one of the worst sex ed curriculums in probably the entire country. It's like literally one of the worst. And whenever we think about, comprehensive sex ed for all, and whenever we think about, what I would have loved to have learned in high school or middle school or, whatever. I would have loved to learn about like those STI and STD prevention. I would have loved to have learned about, positive body image. I would have loved to have learned about, sexual violence and the rates of sexual violence amongst marginalized communities. Whenever we think about that, there's a lot of conversation around, well, if you talk about it, it's going to put it more at risk of happening, right? It's kind of like whenever we talk about mental health and we talk about suicide. Whenever we talk about suicide prevention, it doesn't make somebody more likely to attempt suicide or die by suicide. And there's a lot of negative context around, sex ed. Well, maybe they're too young to be learning about it. I learned about the birds and bees at a very young age, but I also felt traumatized after learning about it. How do we approach, that issue of, well, are they old enough to learn about it? Are they too young to learn about it? I know you've probably heard that a lot, and I've heard it a lot.
Yeah, it's a very, oh, sorry, continue.
How do we combat that?
Yeah, it's a very common question among like that sex educators get. It's often like a you're sexualizing the children, like you're teaching them how to have sex. And it's like I think the most important thing that we have to do is be like the facts, right? We have to say that is not what is happening in classrooms. When we say sex ed or health education, it is often what we call like comprehensive, medically accurate, and age appropriate. So young people, like when we say, oh, sex ed should be given to, you know, K through 12, when we're talking about kindergarten, we're not teaching them about chlamydia and gonorrhea. It's the same way how in kindergarten, they're not learning calculus. They need the foundation first. It's like every other educational pursuit, right? It's like you have to lay the groundwork. They need to know what is the thing between their legs called? What is, what are they called? And should other people touch them? No, right? How do you ask somebody for a hug, right? Because we shouldn't be touching people without their permission and respecting other people, kindness, right? These are all things that are established first before we can talk about pregnancy, before we can talk about chlamydia and gonorrhea, before we can talk about the different birth control methods, right? And I always compare it to that math thing because then people are like, oh, that's a really good point. Like, how can you do that? You can't. You can't teach calculus without teaching 1 + 1 = 2, right? You have to lay the groundwork. And also all of the beyond that, the fact that that is the what is behind all of this. All of the data says that when you teach comprehensive, medically accurate, inclusive sex education, it actually does the opposite of like sexualizing young people. It doesn't make them want to go out and have more sex. Like it just doesn't do that. It gives them the tools and the words, the language to be able to make decisions and form their own values about sex. So they can make the decision to be like, oh, I didn't know that like when you have sex, this thing happens or I could do this and now I can make that decision for myself, right? When we don't teach young people about sex, that is when it is open for misinformation to seep in and shame to seep in and often getting sex through myths and rumors and pornography and all of these things that aren't an accurate outlook of what sex actually is. So, are young people being, hypersexualized by sex ed? No, it's actually the opposite. And we have to keep talking about the facts, talking about, the data, but also being like, hey, think about this, right? Like, we can't do X without Y. We can't do all of this stuff without laying the groundwork. And kids need that. They do. They deserve to know. Something else, sorry, I'm such a talker, but something else that is so interesting, I always tell people is that there is a young people start to understand like their gender at a very, very young age. Like, don't quote me on this. It could be earlier, but around like 5 years old, potentially earlier than that. And also, there are young people are aware of the sensations in their bodies and what we might call this like masturbating, right? But young people often will start to explore and touch themselves and go, oh, this thing feels good. This thing doesn't feel good. What is this? And they want to engage with that and ask questions. And then often adults are the ones to tell them, oh, don't do that. Stop touching that. Don't. And we discourage and we introduce shame so early. So young people, they know about their what's going on between their legs. They're starting to understand that. We have to give them the words, the tools, all of these things so that they can go, oh, this is something, this sensation is what other people have too. Okay, but when I engage with this sensation, I should be doing it in private, right? And it's giving them these, making them feel validated and understood, and also the just all of these tools that they deserve to have.
I know I began experimenting at a young age, and I'll be the first to admit that, and I'm not ashamed of it. At first, whenever trying to come and talk to a trusted adult that I had at that time, they were like, "Oh, you really shouldn't be doing that," and like, "Oh, you're gonna go out and do something that you're gonna regret." And I come to find out, like later on, I think like after being sexually assaulted myself, I learned. Because before I was sexually assaulted, I was very hyper, I was very hyper, and I'm blanking on the word, but I was very like hyperactive, and I was I made some like really weird decisions that I know that I probably shouldn't have, but a lot of that comes from like that shame culture and like learning about that. And then, at that time I was also struggling with my sexuality, my gender identity, struggling with like, just everything. And then also, focused on taking care of my disabled mom, because I had an alcoholic stepdad and I'm the only child. Like, how do I balance, learning about this and then going to school and then, dealing with my grandmother getting sick? So there was a lot that was going on, like, at that time. And it was very tumultuous. And I still had, like, this shame that I was feeling, like, this just, without going directly into it, I did attempt suicide because it got to be a lot and went through a drug addiction and went through conversion therapy for 2.5 years because it's like society told me that I needed to change myself. And I was thinking, like, I got on Google and I was like, rape of LGBTQ people statistics or looking at sexual assault. And I saw that it's at a very, like, astronomical rate. And it's like, why would I continue living this lifestyle if I'm going to be sexually assaulted or if I'm going to be raped or murdered? Or because, those are very real things that pop in somebody's mind. And at that time, who do we really have on social media? We saw a lot of Westboro Baptist Church. We saw a lot of quote unquote ex-gay, therapy going around. And we saw a lot of conversion therapy, or, whatever you want to call it. We saw a lot of that. And, at that age, I was like 16 or 17. Sexually assaulted at 17. So learning about that at that younger age, it was kind of like an eye-opener to me whenever I was around other people who also experienced sexual violence. And I remember the first time sharing my story, they're like, "Oh, you're so courageous. How did you find the strength? And how did you find the courage?" Because people need to know about this. It's the same thing as comprehensive sex ed. It literally all ties in together because if we learn about sex ed at a younger age, it does limit the exposure to violence, and there's a less likelihood of it happening, but it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen because even sex ed is not absolutely perfect, right? So
Absolutely.
walk us through what led you into becoming a sex educator. And let's talk a little bit about your own story.
I first want to also say thank you for sharing all of that. It's so important, and I think it's going to reach, folks listening to this are going to feel like, oh my God, like that feeling of, oh my God, that happened to me too, is so, like you were saying, that Brené Brown quote of like connection and feeling that sense of community is so important. So I did just want to say that. It's hugely impactful for people to hear like, I'm not the only one, and that is, it's game changing. But anyway, how did I get into sex ed? Well, we were talking about voices of strength, and I did that through from like sophomore year of college all the way through senior year of college, and I just absolutely loved it, and it was such a huge part of my identity in college and what I did, and it was my favorite thing that I just always was engaged with, the people that were in the group advisor was one of my mentors. And so I studied in undergrad, I studied biology, and I wanted to go get my PhD in more of like the biology realm. And I got into a pro I had been applying to programs. I did undergraduate research. I was very like STEM girly, I'm gonna go be like a scientist and a professor. And then I got into a program and I was like, this is it, this is what we've been working for. We did it, we did the thing. And then I was like, I cannot sit in a lab for my whole life. And I just started to like rethink everything. And for the first time, I was like, what do I actually want to do that makes me happy? Not just what is like impressive, not just what is actually like impressive, what is going to make a difference? What do I give a shit about? And that's when I realized, I was like, oh, this is what I actually really love. I really love talking about sexual and reproductive health and fighting sexual violence and social justice work and all of that. And so I declined the PhD program And I applied to work at a local Planned Parenthood as a medical assistant. I was an EMT at the time, so I had like medical knowledge and I had the biology background. So I was like, okay, I could do like medical assisting. I could, I know the basics of like patient care. And that's what I did. That was my first job out of college, was becoming a medical assistant at Planned Parenthood, and it was the most transformative job I've ever had and probably ever will have, was sitting down with patients, helping them access their abortions, helping them, get on the birth control of their choice, helping them report sexual violence sometimes was a part of the job that I didn't even know was a thing until I got into it. And it was, yeah, the gift working at Planned Parenthood was such a gift, and it taught me so much of what I know about being a sex educator, was sitting down with patients and being able to talk to them about their experiences. And that really solidified for me, like, oh yeah, this is it, this is what I want to be doing. And from there, it was really sad and hard, but my center had to close. And as we know right now, a lot of Planned Parenthood health centers and reproductive health centers in general are facing financial hardship and are being closed, or they are being, attacked or targeted in some way. And this happened to my center in 2022. And so things have only, it's really hard, but things have only, problems have gotten worse, have exacerbated with a lot of these reproductive health clinics. And even after that, more and more centers in the southeastern Pennsylvania region closed, and across the country in general. So my job was no longer there as a medical assistant, and I started to work in different areas of sex education. And that's kind of when I started to do more social media work too, and also go back to school. That was like my gap year in between college and like grad school. And then I went back to grad school and I started studying human sexuality. And yeah, that kind of leads me like up to today and all of the different facets of my work that I do. But it really all started, in college, and then making that decision of like, yeah, I want to do something that I feel really passionate about that will make a difference. And doing that and figuring out, yeah, this is the thing, this is it.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think you have an absolute incredible journey. And you've done some very impactful work, and you've done some, you're just a well-spoken and well-rounded individual that I have come to know, and I cannot thank you enough for the work that you do and breaking through those barriers and breaking through, shattering those glass ceilings, and I know it's really difficult to be in this space whenever there's so much stigma around sex in itself. And I, you know what? I'm at a, I get tongue twisted.
No,
And
me too. You're all good.
because it's definitely, there's a lot that I want to say, but it's just like, I'm trying to like put everything together and figure out, the best way to phrase these, questions. And, you're a survivor in yourself, it's on your website. You talk about your survivor story. And can you walk us through your survivor story as much as you're wanting to share or willing to share? Because obviously there's a lot to it, but walk us through your survivor journey and, what healing looks like to you.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, this is a really good and important question. And also, I want to say thank you so much, like, for like all the kind words that you've said. And I echo them all back to you, because the work that you do is hugely important. And that is why we all have our own little corner of this work that we and then we come together as this like beautiful puzzle, and it helps so many people in different ways. So I am like honored to be here and like be in the same like circle and space as you. It means everything. But yeah, my survivor story is definitely, I wouldn't say it is one that is like typical, but I don't think anyone's survivor story is really typical, right? In the movies, it's like, that the trope of like the innocent victim of like, she was so helpless and she was this tiny little girl. And I think a lot of people think that. And then often when I tell my story, it's like I wasn't really that. Like, for a lot of my abusive relationship. Like I had consented and I had been like an active part of that, and probably, and I was someone who yelled back and I, talked back. I wasn't just this person who was just kind of there accepting all of it. But it was in high school, I guess it kind of starts there. I was never, I always like kind of questioned by myself and like I didn't have like great self-esteem, and I was always just like, I would have done anything for male validation and male attention. I was like, I want to be liked so badly. And I think that is something that's really common among young women. And then I got to college and someone started giving me that, and they started giving me the attention and that praise, but it was more love bombing. It was a lot more of those, toxic things that we see and hear now often, and that are more talked about now than were talked about even like 5, 10 years ago, I would say. Like so much, like the online space has transformed vocabulary and the words that people are able to use to explain what happened to them. Like someone once said like love bombing and financial abuse, and I went, oh my God, yeah. I was just like, it clicked. I was like, that's the thing that happened to me, right? And it was just like the I love yous, like very early in the relationship. It was the cutting me off from having other friends and even making me feel guilty for studying or doing my homework, wanting to spend all of his time with me, and all of these things are so just like it marks a very toxic relationships that you look back in hindsight and you go, how did I not see it? But when you're in the crux of it, when you're in the thick of it, you don't always see it. So it was it got to a certain point. There was also, I won't go into this, but there were also certain components of sexual violence in there that I will not delve into for my own comfort and safety, but also for the comfort and safety of other folks listening. But anyway, a lot of the abuse happened when the relationship had actually ended. And he, I broke things off, and he would, follow me around campus. He would chase me around campus. It was experiences of stalking quite a bit, both online, relentless messaging, and in person on campus. And it was horrifying. Like it changed the way that I think about like staying home alone, the way I think about walking around spaces and in my neighborhood. And stalking was something that I was like, it's romanticized in all of the movies and stuff. And I'm like, oh, this person really wants them, and that's so cute and sweet. And then you live it and you're like, oh shit, it is not like that at all. It is a horrifying gut feeling in your stomach that you have. And so eventually it got to a point where we had what was called like a no contact order, which was kind of like a restraining order on campus. But they called it a no contact order because it was a mutual no contact order, even though he was the one that was persistently trying to contact me. That is what they call it on my college campus through like Title IX and all of those, more specific education and legal things. But eventually he ended up transferring and leaving the college altogether. But seeing him around and seeing, the people that he surrounded himself with was like, it made me feel sick sometimes. The way that it manifests in the physical body is absolutely, it's gut-wrenching, it's horrifying, it is sickening. And it was, I started to have some of my first experiences of like panic attacks and not wanting to leave my room at college, and delving into some of my darker like mental health experiences as well. And it's just, I don't think people always realize the toll that something, even people would say as harmless as stalking is, or as harmless as like persistent messaging is, really is, it takes away so much from a person. It vacuums so much from them and out of them and from their soul. And it was just that feeling of like being empty and having just like exhaustion from having to deal with those things over periods of time. But something that's interesting is that after that ended, I sought like the next person. I went, and a lot of people invalidated like my experience because they're like, well, if it was that bad, why'd you go and date somebody like within a few months after? And a lot of people, that is their experience after trauma, after sexual violence, after dating abuse, right? It's they're like, I don't know how to be alone. I don't want to be alone with my own thoughts. I don't, how do I cope? And often it is seeking more sex. It's seeking more validation from external sources. And for some people, they do the opposite, and they go the opposite direction of feeling like they don't ever want to have sex or they don't ever want to date someone. But for me, it was a little bit the opposite of kind of jumping into more relationships. And yeah, it was journeys when it comes to sexual violence and dating abuse and domestic violence and all of the things under within that realm are no two experiences are exactly alike in the aftermath. No two responses to trauma are the same, and whatever like your response to trauma is to anyone, it doesn't invalidate your experience even to the slightest. And that's something that I can't like express enough is, whether you're someone who fought back or you yelled back, you weren't the perfect victim, you didn't fall in the perfect victim trope, or you, after your relationship, you still went and had sex with other people, or after your experience, you still went out and had sex and sought that out, that doesn't invalidate your experience. You are still someone who experienced that trauma, and you deserve respect and dignity and to be believed. And I think too often we use some of those reactions in the aftermath as a way to invalidate survivors and victims of violence. And yeah, that's a little bit of my story, but I also think the story is ongoing. It's forever. I'm always living. The way I see it is I'm always living in the aftermath of that. I see a lot of my life, and I kind of, it is what it is for me, and it's how I see my life, but I'm also like, damn, I hate that I see it in this way. But it was like before that experience and after. I feel like it changed me dramatically in a lot of ways that affected me negatively, but also changed me as a person and the way I like use that trauma towards other things. And it I never would wish it on anyone else, but I think sometimes I'm like, what would life be if I hadn't experienced this? What like that before versus after? What would things look like for me? And I have so many thoughts, and like often think about it, even though it was years and years ago. But yeah, that's the story is ongoing. The journey is forever, is how I see it. And I'm always healing and growing and working on my healing.
Thank you for sharing your personal story. And you mentioned about like the perfect victim, the disqualification of survivors, and also, it reinforces those stereotypes. And it does a lot of like the radicalization aspect. And it also leads into like more human trafficking and domestic abuse cases. There is no such thing as a perfect victim because everybody's different. Everybody handles trauma different. Everybody handles things just not even just trauma. I mean, like, there's often times that I figure out, like, well, what am I going to eat for dinner tonight? Right. And like, those are some of those questions that, pop in your mind. But this goes deeper than that, right? Because this is like, if I come forward and share my story, what are those implications that come after that? And the ramification aspect, if I go and tell the police, are they going to believe me? Are they going to listen to me? If I go talk to my Title IX office, are they going to sit and listen to me, or are they going to shame me and blame me? And oftentimes survivors get asked these questions of, well, what were you wearing? Or, and in some states, there are, New York being one state, and then there's a couple other states that have this loophole, which is the voluntary intoxication loophole. which kind of implies that if you drink alcohol and you consented well, and then you later come forward and say, I think I was sexually assaulted, there's a loophole that they don't have to prosecute those cases. And they don't even have to look at those cases. Sometimes they will look at them, sometimes they'll bring them to court, but oftentimes that loophole is what, derives a lot of people of their justice that they rightfully deserve. And there's nothing worse than telling the survivor, I don't believe you. I was told, I don't believe you. Well, why weren't you? You're a man. Why didn't you just fight him off? Why didn't you, why didn't you just say no? Well, would I be here trying to report if I did say no? Like, let's be real here. My mom's also a survivor, and going to my local police department and hearing them say, well, I don't believe you, or are you not strong enough to fight him off? And it's just, oh God. And it was
It's
in the worst part, my first sexual assault was on Easter, this this Christian holiday. And I consider myself as a progressive Christian myself, but religion is also very tough with me and very tricky. But of all holidays for this to fall on, it was Easter. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And religious trauma does exist, and I want to acknowledge that. And that's actually one of the series that we're doing is about religious trauma. And then also, like LGBTQ people. And then we have a series on trafficking. We have a series on a number of other things that we're currently working on. And this podcast has turned into something that I never imagined it would ever turn into. And this movement started as a 3 a.m. conversation last August and has turned into 211,000 followers later across social media. Never imagined this would ever happen. But Jill, I want to say thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. And I guess my last question to you is, what's next for you? Like, where are you? What's next for you? Where are you headed? Just walk us through what's next.
Oh my God. What part of the question is like, or part of the answer is like, who knows, right? And I try to be open with that too, because I feel like for so long I was always like, this is the exact path. And then I actually pursued like the career that I'm in, and I was like, oh, my path was funky and weird, and it wasn't ex any in any way, shape, or form like I thought it would be. So now I'm just kind of like, we go with the flow, we see what comes. But right now I am I just started my dissertation phase of my PhD in human sexuality. So the goal is always to be like an educator in whatever form. And education is the thing that really means the most to me. And whether it's a conversation on the street with someone you just met, or whether it's in a lecture hall, or whether it's on a Zoom call, right? It's like education is so powerful in all of its forms. And that is, whatever does come next, I know it's about giving people the tools and the language and the words and the concepts to be able to make sense of things and take action and help themselves, help the people around them, make the world a better place. And that's always what's next. But yeah, in actuality, it is doing my independent research for my dissertation, and hopefully, over the next couple of years, getting my PhD. But I'm always on doing the social media sex ed. I am always, doing life and work and all of the things. And I guess personal life wise, in well, we're recording right at the time of recording, it is less than 2 weeks until I get married, which is really exciting. So my wedding is in about 2 weeks, and I say that also because like it's exciting, and that's the thing that's really next for me. But also that like happiness and love and acceptance are possible after experiencing abuse and trauma. And my partner is one of the most special, understanding, kind people that I never thought I would be able to find after my experience. So like I say that, like I said, as a this is what's next for me, but also like it could be next for you too. And it will be next for you too if that is what you want. You deserve love and dignity and respect and all of the rich experiences, regardless of the trauma that you faced. So yeah.
Congratulations on getting married. That
Oh,
is
thank you.
incredible. So incredibly proud, and to continue watching you grow and continue watching you experience what you absolutely deserve. And Jill, I cannot thank you enough for being this positive energy that so many need right now. And, talking about these difficult subjects, but turning it into breaking the stigma, breaking, these barriers, and just, you're just a badass human being. I hope you realize that, and I hope
Oh,
you
thank
understand
you.
that. And I am so looking forward to seeing these pictures of your wedding,
Oh my
and
God, yes.
assuming you have pictures. But I am so incredibly proud of you. And then, you obviously have an open invite anytime to come on the podcast, and I'm sure our listeners absolutely enjoy listening to you. Is
Oh,
there anything else? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I'm sending all of the love, everything right back to you because it is such an honor to be here and to be in your presence and to like be within this movement and stuff too, and to like amplify each other's work. It like means the world to me, and we're and to see like the growth of Rise Above Justice movement too has been like incredible. Because like I remember when y'all first like sent me a DM, I was like, oh my God, they know who I am. What the hell? I was so excited. And that was how much like y'all have meant to me and how much I have been following the work of you guys. And it's just, I can't wait to see where it all goes for you. But I am always a big fan, big supporter of you and Rise Above Justice movement, and everything you say means like hitting me right in the heart. It means so much to me.
Likewise, my friends. And I remember that first DM, and you're like, "You want to talk to me?" It was like, "What? What
Literally.
the
Literally. I was like, who, me?
Little old me.
Yeah, oh my God, that's hilarious. But yeah, no, it really was like surreal. And it still is surreal because it's like to be in community with such all the folks that you guys interact with, and everyone in this space is just like, we all care so much, and we all fight endlessly for this work and for this cause and everything surrounding it, social justice, racial justice, LGBTQIA plus rights, abortion rights, all of it is just everyone has their own little corner, like I said earlier, and it's we all support each other in this work, and it's just so magical. Like there's really no, it's magical the way that everyone just stands up for one another and shows up for one another and does the work, and it's, yeah, it's brilliant.
I always say that if we don't do it, nobody else is going to. And that's the reality of it, because there are a ton of people in this movement. There are a ton of people doing things in this movement. However, there's not nearly enough conversation around it, and mainstream media does not amplify these conversations. Mainstream media does not amplify a lot of the work that's going on the grounds in our communities. So it's up to the movements like mine and the movements and social media accounts like yours, and amplifying the work of each other is absolutely incredibly crucial. Collaborations are deeply, needed right now, and we need to get this information out there, because Department of Education is not going to get comprehensive sex ed in all of our public schools. They're not. They literally are not. And it does not matter who the administration is. This is something that has been a conversation for many, many decades, and they refuse to do so. And whatever, by refusing, they're setting our future generations up for failure. Literally, these students that are going through our schools are going to become our future sex educators, or become our future teachers, or become our future, whatever path they decide to choose. But whenever they don't have those tools to set them up for success, what exactly are we allowing to happen? Where, we have the school to prison pipeline that continuously goes on. And you know this, I know that, but how do we get other people to understand it? That's a question that I honestly have no idea what the answer could be. I mean, I do, but are they going to listen? Probably not. But overall, Jill, thank you again for coming on the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Again, my name is Zachary, and I'm the host of this podcast. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be here.
Absolutely. You have a good day, okay?
You too.
Okay.